Hi, everyone. This is Brooke James. Welcome to The Grief Coach. This is a special episode as part of our series on dating after loss, which is being co-hosted by Megan Reardon Jarvis. And today we have with us Juliana Wexler, and we're going to talk about dating after loss. Juliana is the founder of Parama, where she guides individuals and companies in compassionate navigation of transitions and difficult conversations and negotiations, which I think we will talk a little bit about how you ended up doing that and how that was influenced by some of the stuff we're going to talk about today. So Megan and Juliana, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having us. I'm excited.
All right. Some of you may remember Megan from episode 55, where we talked about the neuroscience of grief, and a recent episode, I think 63, where we started the Dating After Loss series. So for those of you who are not familiar with Megan, she is a trauma therapist, and her and I started talking a few months ago and got along swimmingly and decided no one was talking about dating after loss. And so we were going to do it. Megan and I will be chatting with Juliana, and we're excited to get into it. So Juliana, if you want to introduce yourself, give the audience a little bit of context as to who you are, what's your story, and then we'll get into everything.
Yeah, definitely. So I got divorced 3 years ago. I married my boyfriend from college in my late 20s and then got divorced right around my 30th birthday, which kind of started this whole journey into myself, which eventually became my business. And we'll talk about more of that later, but really just like a reorientation of the entire course of my life. And that has been such a loss, and really like the process of me going through that loss, that was this relationship that spanned from 20 to 30, was so much grieving for me. And it's been really interesting to parallel that against books about grief, and which is traditionally like obviously death. And so to kind of use that as a guide to get me through this kind of like progressive understanding of grief, which can be any sort of loss.
Right. And I'm so glad you said that, because after, like, pretty soon after my dad died, someone put me in touch with a friend who was talking about the death of her marriage and the grief she was feeling about it. And because the loss from my dad, who died physically, was still so new, I was like really offended that was the language people were choosing to use. But now, like 2 years out, I can see like, well, we just don't have other language for it. So that could be, I don't know, I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so, and it doesn't have to be, it's not to put it to make them the same, because they're not the same at all. It's just like an umbrella term, right? So exactly. There is grief, and then within grief, death is likely the most prominent and intense form of grief, but then there are other forms of grief too.
Right, exactly.
What's interesting about it, I think, is that, you know, Brooke just said something about we don't have the right language. You know, there's all the social psychologists who are trying to help us get better language. They give us words like disenfranchised grief, and they're trying to give us better language so that people can understand what's going on. There's the personalized element, and then there's also, you know, this is something that happens to people in their lives. But the part that I think I just want to highlight it is, you know, for a woman in the world, there is this social construct around getting married, which is like a developmental achievement. It's like a lifetime thing. And people look at you and say, you did it. You found your partner. You have figured things out. Maybe your parents even say that. Oh, I'm so relieved. I know what her life is going to look like. Particularly when you get divorced young, all of that crashes down in a way that's like developmentally disturbing. Does that make sense to you?
Oh yeah. I mean, and that was my experience. And, you know, it's funny, my parents are both clinical psychologists, and my mom, you know, and feminists. And I think that they did a relatively good job of trying not to program me any more than the media and my peers did about marriage and what that meant. But a lot of it came from me and, you know, internalized beliefs about what it meant to be married, and that marriage meant success, and that you've made it in the world, and that you're lovable, and everything that goes along with that in our culture. And so the death of that, and for me, it was failure and shame. And we'll talk about like what led to me, the marriage ending, but there was so much shame around failure and around just it not working and losing that, and like losing this whole chunk of my life, that it was really like the death of my ego and the death of a big part of my identity.
I love that you said death of your ego, because I think based on what Megan was saying, dating, it, especially for a young woman, and getting married, like it's seen as a prize. And there is so much, and I don't know how much you're reading about, like, or I don't know if we're reading the same things, but certain like dating advice is you need to think less of, does he like me, but like, do I like him? I think the ego is a really important thing to recognize, that like that's a part of the equation. I don't know, Megan, if you have any thoughts on that, with you have way more academic training than I do on this.
I mean, listen, I think we probably all have the same training, in the sense that everybody has to take the risk to date at some point in their lives. And depending on where you are when you do that, you know, I'm a bunch older than you guys, like depending on where you are when you do that, you are holding that present day experience of your life. So if it's you're dating and you're, you know, not that far out from your dad's death, then you are holding that experience of feeling awkward around loss. How do I talk to someone? Do I tell them? Do I not tell them? You know, how do I feel about it? Do I want to talk about it? How are they going to feel about it? There's all of that. And I think, you know, that I think it's different to get divorced when you're 50 and you have a business that you've been running for 25 years and you've lived in a neighborhood and, I don't know, raised kids or been to the county fair with friends. Like, I think that's different. The county fair.
Yeah, county fair really paints a picture.
Really paints a picture.
Really, where most people make their friends. But I think that's different, right, than when you are just trying to figure out what's going on in your life, who you're going to be in the world, and you end up having to lose your partner, the person that's been helping you feel like it's all going to be okay, or I am okay, right? Because that's what attachment is about. Attachment from the earliest stages with little babies. Little babies look at their mothers when they are distressed, and the mothers reflect back in their eyes, you are okay. And the baby settles. The baby calms down by the gaze of the mom or the touch. And you know what? We do that for the rest of our damn lives. Like, we find our people, we call them when we need to, and we say, is it all going to be, you know, am I okay? Is it going to be okay? And I think our life partners are meant to be the people that we turn to in those moments. And so when you're in that developmental stage of like trying to figure out who you're going to be in the world, and there really is this huge growth edge, I mean, for men and women, but I work with a lot of men, and they do not have the same social pressure, maybe from their mom, but like not from their peer group, where it's like, you're really gonna, wow, you've really achieved something by finding your life partner at age 20. That's just not a thing that men have in the same way.
Yeah. And for me, one of the hardest parts was I didn't know anyone my age who was getting divorced. And I had some friends who were a few years older, you know, in their, you know, 34, 35, who said, just give it a few years. All these weddings you're going to go to are going to start crumbling, which, you know, now being 33, like I know way more people that are divorced, but at 29, 30, it was like, what? I had no one to look up to kind of expand my view that like I could get divorced and be okay. So, and it's hard to believe that that's possible in that case.
Well, and it's so interesting that you say that, because I had the same experience of like losing my dad, of like most of the people who had lost a parent, it happened when they were like in an adolescent, younger. And so I didn't have a peer group which is the reason I started the podcast, to say like, okay, what do I do about this as late 20s, early 30s? And like, what is this loss like? And what does this look like? I think, and what Megan always says, of like, at this point in my life. So I think that's really interesting. But Megan, I think you were going to say something also. Sorry to
cut you off. What I was going to say exactly what you just said, which is, you know, the concept of like, when you lost your dad, you didn't have five other friends who had already lost you know, Brooke knows this, but after my mom died, I went to inpatient treatment because I was just so dysregulated. And I was totally stunned. There were 18 people there and 10 of them had lost their moms. Mm. And it was such a relief to sit in a room and not have to explain how like mind-boggling it was to me to have lost this significant attachment. They were all different ages, but I really don't, I mean, now actually I do, but at that time I didn't have a single peer who had lost their mom. Several had lost their dads, but not their mom. And I think there is something about, it made me, and I'm curious for you guys, but it made me self-conscious. It made me feel like people were like trying to show up, but also like looking at me, maybe judging me, but definitely like looking at me. And so I had this kind of like aloneness that was so deep because I couldn't look to anyone and sort of say, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like you know.
I really relate to that. I have this joke with my friends that people always, when I'm being introduced to someone and there's a friend of a friend that's divorced, they always like kind of hit me and go, Juliana, he's divorced too. And not even in like a dating way, just like in a, oh, he's one of you.
Yeah,
he gets it. And it's a funny thing to be defined by. And it's taken me a while to be okay with that, to like work through my own shame of being okay. It's okay. This can be a label, something that happened to me, but it's not all that I am. But yeah, I mean, when there's not a lot, there's definitely a sense of self-consciousness, a self of like, you're kind of wearing this hat that outs you as this person that went through this thing, and everyone knows that about you, and it's kind of scary.
Tell us about the shame part, because I think that that's something, it's not that that,
yeah.
In primary loss, you know, when your brother dies or your cousin dies, I think the loss is the same and the grieving is the same, but I don't know that in other types of loss, people have shame in the same way that you're describing. So I'd love to know more about that.
Yeah, I was actually wanted to bring that up because I was thinking about like what all of the differences between death and other types of grief, and I mean, specifically divorce, because that's the only one I can really speak on. And the significance of the loss is much, much greater with death, but there's no shame. So it's very different in the sense of like, it's not, you're not blaming yourself. You're not embarrassed to tell people. You might think that, I mean, I'm obviously, tell me if I'm wrong, but that's what I've had known from friends whose parents have died, is that it's generally not something that causes shame. And divorce carries with it so much shame and so much baggage, particularly for a 30-year-old woman, kind of this like divorcee stigma is certainly not something, you know, when I think of a divorcee woman, I think of a 40-something woman who drinks too much red wine and talks about younger guy. You know, it's like a very, it's
sounds
not,
awesome.
It's not, yeah, it's not a, it's not something that I would say like is aspirational for me. So I've had to really overcome that. And for me, my shame came from the primary reason that my marriage ended when it did is I had an affair, and we can obviously get into that. And that was what prompted the marriage to end. My ex-husband really painted quite an unflattering picture of me to our entire social group. And that I felt like the town whore. Like I felt really shamed, and I was like wearing this scarlet letter of A for adulterer. Like I was bringing back like a lot of witchy vibes for me of kind of being like really like ostracized, yeah. And what that meant. And it just carried so much weight for me.
Yeah. Is there, so I just want to say for the people who are listening that the like clinical definition of shame, so there's like humiliation, guilt, shame, you know, there's all these words that sort of cluster in, and I borrow my definitions from Brené Brown because I feel like she, you know, she's the guru and the queen and the goddess of all these things, but it's important to say it because guilt is about something that I did. And I do think there's a ton of guilt for people. Brooke, I don't know if you felt this, but there's a ton of guilt around grief in general. Like even if it's magical thinking, I wish that I had been there with my sister in Alaska when she drowned. Like there was no way that was ever going to happen, but I still can have that kind of guilt. Mm-hmm. And certainly with both of my parents, I have very odd guilt that I still sit with. The concept of shame is more, I am the bad thing.
Yeah.
Happened, right?
Well, and other people think you are the bad thing. I think with guilt, I don't know if I necessarily have guilt around my dad's death, but I do have like, wow, if I knew then what I know now, I would have done a couple of things differently. I had a lot of guilt around, oh, I acted really not the right way. And I had no idea of like when my mom's dad died, when my mom's sister died, when my dad's mom died. Like I was like, I thought I knew and I thought I was doing the right thing. And like my mom's sister, like I'm very close with those cousins. And I thought I was doing a really good job being a support to them. And then after my dad died, I was like, oh my God, I had no fucking clue. Like, and so I don't know, there's, for me, that's not shame, but it is guilt. But I think that differentiation on the language between guilt and shame is one is within us and one is what are other people thinking is a really good delineation to me.
Well, and you also mentioned regret. So I'm just going to say that when we look back and we say like, oh, I wish that I had done something different, that's regret. And I just think nobody gets through anything painful without some sort of regret. Like that is my bias. My belief is we look back at things that hurt and wish they could have hurt less. And we have beliefs like if I had done X, Y, and Z. But say, Juliana, say more about sort of where that, like, like how did you carry that? How did you get out of it? Like, where is it now?
So I think it, you know, everything in adulthood, if you believe in like any kind of archetypal psychology or developmental psychology, Jungian stuff, that it was all just confirm that relationship and the exiting of it was confirming beliefs that I picked up in childhood, which were, I believed my whole childhood that there was something wrong with me, that I was different, that I didn't quite fit in, that like I was too much emotionally, that I was never going to be happy. And so I kind of like fit myself into this box in my 20s in this relationship and in this life living in Manhattan and, you know, working in a corporate setting and trying to be all the things that I thought looked good. And then when that all fell apart for me, I started hearing old voices, some of which were coming directly from my ex-husband and his family, telling me literally like, you have a character flaw, in those words. And that really triggered my own internalized shame. And so it wasn't, it's not like his fault that he didn't, you know, it was triggering some old belief that I had. And it was like, oh, this is confirmed. And that kind of like turned on this faucet of like a lot of shame and a lot of like, I am bad. Not so as speaking to the guilt versus shame, guilt would be like, I did something bad. I hurt him. You know, I had an affair. That's wrong. Blah, blah, blah. Shame was like, I am bad. There is something wrong with me. I will never be happy. I will never be happy in relationship. I will never be able to settle down. Like a lot of like really globalized, really grandiose statements that were like projecting out who I am and my character and what it meant about me that, I mean, really held me back for like, certainly the first year, year and a half. It's been 3 years now. And I would say like the first year, I just heard his, it was all like personified through his voice. And I would just like hear that voice over and over in my head, like kind of haunting me. And then since then, I went to quit my job and left New York and traveled in Europe for several months. And that was sort of when I came back to home to myself, I would say, and like really got clear on working through a lot of the shame and understanding that it actually had nothing to do with him. It was like beliefs that I had about myself from childhood that he was just confirming and his family and friends were just confirming. And like by letting him have that power over me, he, you know, it wasn't about him. It was removing him from the equation and just making this like, oh, these are beliefs that I've had from childhood. Let me work through some, I did a lot of shadow work and a lot of inner child work and trying to like unravel those beliefs that I picked up that he was just there as a mirror to like show me where I needed to do this work.
It's fascinating to hear you say this because even without going into all the details of what those beliefs are, Brooke, I'm interested to hear what you would say about this, but I think any loss brings up the garbage from childhood, right? Like anyone I have ever worked with, and there are hundreds who are struggling to adapt and carry this loss that they either didn't expect to have, or now that they have it, it feels too heavy, that I think every single person is confronting a series of beliefs that either they inherited or sort of were created when they were children, that part of them still believes. And I would say that's true for me. You know, I'm a trauma therapist. I have had all of the therapy. And when my mom died, I had a sense of loss, like core, I don't know who I am anymore loss in relation to my mom. That was literally the fear that I carried around as a child. Like if something happens to her, I won't be able to function. Our family won't be safe. And I'm 47, I'm safe. I don't need a mommy anymore, but that still was the primary sensation. And that required some inner child work, some, you know, not quite shadow work, but same idea. So Brooke, I'm just curious about that. Would you say in your experience with your loss with your dad, that the things that were scary or difficult or beliefs that you held that maybe don't need to be held in adulthood popped up in the loss of him?
I do think a little bit similar to Juliana did a like, I'm going to run away to Europe for a little while and really did a big change on like, how am I spending my time? What am I doing with my time? I had, I think a certain, so this might fit into kind of what you're asking, Megan. I had a certain picture of like, my life should be like, I'm going to be super successful, work really hard, like work in like consulting, finance, whatever. I'm going to wear a blazer and like, whatever. The business card and the businesswoman. After he died, I was like, oh, I hated every single job I had. Like I hated them and was miserable. And so for the past 2 years, I've been kind of doing a lot of different things and figuring out like, well, what do I want to do and how do I want to spend my time? And it's so different than what I thought I would be doing when I was growing up. And my life kind of looks different than what I thought it would look like. Like if you had told me 5 years ago I was gonna talk about grief every week, I'd be like, you are out of your goddamn mind. Like, and so right. So like I certainly think it changed some of the beliefs on like what I thought my life was gonna be and what I thought I was supposed to be doing, but would have to like reflect a little more to see if there was further stuff.
It's interesting because all three of us spend some time to ourselves, like traveling or whatnot after significant loss. So that's just like an interesting theme. Brooke knows that I took my family and we did a road trip for 4 months, and people, my peers are like, oh, it's so good. That was such a good thing for you to do as a mom with your kids. And I'm pretty blunt about stuff. So I'm like, no, that was just me grieving and like grieving in a way that was more manageable. I couldn't sit at home. I'd love to hear more about what your process was like, because it sounds like it helped you. You use this phrase that I love, which is come home to myself. Mm-hmm. But like, I'd love to know let me back up. I think I'm going to speak for women because I've always only been a woman, but I think women are told a lot of things about what's going to instruct them into having a good and happy life. And I have many women who hit that plateau. I have done all the things that I was told that I was supposed to do. I went to college. I got a good job. I'm wearing a suit. I'm following the rules. I found a partner, and they are fucking furious to discover this does not feel in my body and in my experience, in my world, the way you told me it was going to feel. And so there's this like need for reinvention, which I think really is at the primary root of a divorce, right? Which is this relationship, this life that we have together is not what I want. And I have to go and get it some other way, or, you know, I think we feel like we suffocate. So I'm curious about what your process was.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely my experience. I just thought if I could get my life to look the way I thought it should look, then it would feel the way I wanted it to feel. And so everything in my 20s was about like having the right wedding, having the right job, buying the right apartment. And there was a lot of materialism and a lot of like trying to get the right jobs and trying to get the right friends, and trying to go on the right trips and trying to, you know, all the things. And then I just woke up and thought like, this, I don't want this. And, you know, a lot of things went wrong in our marriage. I mean, he had an affair with someone he worked with when he was engaged, which sort of started this spiral of like, okay, this is not as great as maybe we thought it was. We decided to get married anyway after going to therapy, which was an interesting decision in hindsight on my part, but I think it served, there was still more to work through there. And then there were a lot of things, but we had a really poor sexual chemistry, and we started seeing a sex therapist. And I realized that like, I wasn't sexually attracted to him. And it like came very clearly when the sex therapist asked us, like, kind of jokingly, like, just to make sure, like, you guys are sexually attracted to each other, right? And I said, yeah, but I just knew right then, like, oh shit, no.
You can't.
And that was the end for me. I mean, mentally. Yeah. And then several months later, this person that I worked with came into my life, and that was that. But it was like, that was sort of the realization that like this life that I had built was not what I wanted. And it took about 6 months for that to actually unravel of me like trying really, I was holding on so tightly because I was like, no, this is what I want. I'm doing all the things that I think are successful. I'm like living the life that like I grew up watching on TV and that I thought I wanted to be this successful boss woman. Like I wanted all these things and I can't just let them go just because we don't have good sexual chemistry. But then, I mean, there was like not enough emotional intimacy. Obviously there were more things that were wrong. And so for me, it was letting go of that entire image that of the world that I had created for myself. Mm-hmm. And so then it was like, well, where do I start? So the company that I was working for had just failed to raise their next round of funding. That happened right as I was getting divorced. So I was out of a job, had moved out of my apartment that we owned into Brooklyn, was like living on my own for the first time ever, was obviously in a ton of grief. My ex-husband wouldn't speak to me. I lost half of my friend group. Like it was like, there was just so much loss. And I remember saying to my therapist at the time, like, I have no anchors. Like all of these things in my life that were anchors are gone. And she said, you have to learn to be your own anchor. And I thought like, there's no way I can do that. Like that's just like not possible. And I think going to Europe, and that was like, it took me about several months to be able to get to the point of like, okay, I've sort of rebuilt my life enough. I'm not fleeing the scene. I'm going to choose to leave the new job that I had and then go to Europe. And what that meant was like, okay, now it's actually time to become my own anchor. And I think if I had left, and I thought about like, should I just leave New York right when this happened? And I thought, I don't want to. It doesn't feel right. It feels like I need to wait a little bit, rebuild my life a little bit, and leave from not like a fleeing the scene situation, but from a place that's like, okay, I can do this, but I'm choosing to do something different. And so when I went to Europe, I mean, I was alone. I had never spent like that kind of time by myself. I was in nature, I was hiking every day. I was just like getting all this channeled information. I was journaling so much, like just like all so much was opening for me. And it really opened up this whole world of like forgiving myself and kind of like doing these, I was doing these visualizations of trying to forgive him and like visualizing him forgiving me and me forgiving myself. And I think it was in Europe that I learned that I have to be able to be okay by myself and that no one, like I have to be able to self-soothe. And I don't think that I ever really learned how to self-soothe when I was in that relationship, because there was just like, when you're with someone all the time, like you kind of just go to them for support. And I, you know, to be 30 and be in this situation where all you have is yourself. I mean, I had family and friends, but they were mostly not in New York. And you really learn like, okay, I'm all I can count on. And so I have to make peace with all of the parts of myself. And it became more like, I'm hanging out with the different parts of myself. Like today I'm hanging out with my shadow. Today I'm hanging out with me at 4 years old. Today I'm hanging out with me that was like a college girl. You know, like it's like how to come to peace with like all of the parts of myself that got me here and love them. And that was difficult, but really transformational. And it's funny, you know, Megan, you said something about confronting your beliefs. And that's a lot of what I do in my business now is like, it's all about confrontation. Like you have to be able to confront all of the parts of yourself if you have any hope of confronting the external world and, you know, confronting your boss or confronting your partner. And that really started for me in Europe of confronting myself, taking a hard look at myself.
It's such an interesting word, confront, right? Because it has like some assertiveness to it. Mm-hmm. It's not, let's all get around a campfire and kumbaya with my partner.
Right.
It's like,
right. And confront has kind of a negative connotation. It's a little in your face. It's a little aggressive, but I think you can do it. So the work that I do, I call conscious confrontation, which is about, you know, confronting in a more compassionate and conscious way. It's like, we don't have to take the aggressiveness out of it. It's just setting boundaries and standing up for yourself with no anger and aggression.
Yeah. The one thing that I was thinking about is the way that you were describing the process of like taking all that time for yourself. Again, mm-hmm. I would say thematically with loss, all the losses out there, part of what we have to do is quiet the white noise of other people's opinions and judgments. And in my case, it was children, it was needs. We, you know, my kids needed to be tucked in at night and I needed to be in my own, I needed to be tucking myself in. But I think I just want to point out for people that are listening, it's really hard work, this experience of grieving and loss. It's, you know, we are not pathologizing each other. We're not saying like, oh, well, I'm really sorry. That was so hard for you. You had a really hard time. What we are saying is it is really fucking hard to do it. All three of us took large chunks out of our lives. And again, you know, and I'm trained in this like full-time all the time. And you've become an expert in this full-time all the time. Brooke knows all the things and all the people full-time all the time. And still what all three of us are saying is it's really hard. Tell us how you took that transformation piece and then stepped into the ring of dating again. Like how, yeah. Like what did you do? Did the self-consciousness come back? You know, just that feels very, very brave to me.
Yeah. So the first year, so I got divorced in the spring of 2018 and I had never online dated or anything, you know, because I'd been with my ex since, I don't know, you know, 2009 or something. And so I thought, okay, I need to make an online dating profile and just like see what this is all about. And I don't, you know, had so many friends doing this, so I knew how to do it. And I went on like 3 or 4 first dates that I was not interested in them at all, but it was like, okay, I know how to do this. I can do this. Like, I'm okay. And then I kind of put it down and thought, I'm not ready to date, but it's like, okay, I know how, I know that like I can go on this in this new world of dating and like be okay when I'm ready. Mm-hmm. And then I traveled in the fall. And then I came back in January of 2019 and started a new job and briefly dated someone in that winter and spring. And he triggered so much. He just like, he was fine with the divorce. He actually was like, helped me see that I didn't need to be ashamed by that at all. Like he didn't care at all. He thought it was an interesting story and, you know, had carried no weight, which has been a recurring theme for me of like how little people care that I'm divorced, particularly people that I date. It's like, yeah, okay. Lots of people are like, yeah, that's not that weird, which has been really helpful. But I realized by how much he was triggering my own stuff, like my own feelings of unworthiness and not enoughness, that I was not ready to date. And that was part of what prompted me to go to Europe was like, oh, I have more work to do on myself to be ready to go into the dating world. And I was really unhappy in that job. And it was kind of just the combination of like what it was like being in the dating world and feeling like still really unhealed and having some shame around that. Because again, we have this narrative that like, you get back out there. Like all of my friends were like, come on, like go on more dates, like go out more, like, well, that's how you'll get over it. And that's not how I get over things. And I know that about myself. Like I need to go into a cocoon, heal, and then I will come out fresh and ready to go. And that's exactly what happened. But it was like that pressure of, why don't you just do this? Or why don't you just do that? And like that, I needed to go away. I needed to like be literally in a different continent where I knew no one and take time to myself. I did a lot of work obviously in Europe. And then when I moved to DC, right before COVID started, so beginning of March 2020, I immediately started dating someone. We were together for a year. We just broke up a few months ago. But that relationship and seeing how he, particularly, he was so not only not judgmental about me being divorced, but like thought it gave me a unique perspective on relationships that people my age generally don't have, and was so like comforting about it that I feel now dating, gone on a few dates since that breakup, but my essence and how I show up to a date and who I am is really different having been in that year-long relationship where like I have gotten past so much of the shame of being divorced. Like I just feel the way that I speak about it, the way that I'm not scared to bring it up, the way that it's like not something like I have to say on a first date, but I will if it comes up. It just feels like the charge that it had, like the emotional charge and the heaviness and the weight and the significance of it is gone. And now it's just like, oh yeah, it's like me saying like I used to live in New York. I mean, it's not that neutral, but it's more just like a fact about me than it is like this thing that defines me and like is something that I'm like hesitant to say. It's just something that I say neutrally.
That's so interesting, because I was going to ask of like, when do you bring it up and how do you bring it up when you're dating? Because for me and people who listen to the episode where I kind of talk about my dating experience, at first I would say it like first date, like whatever. And then this guy who I'm seeing now, I waited for like a month, and then I wouldn't let him listen to the podcast for like 2.5 months. And it felt different. And I don't know why I did that. That's just how things happened. But I think like I have friends who are divorced who don't say it on, like they wait a while. It sounds like though you've done so much work to accept that this is just like a part of you and it's part of your story, and like to release the shame that like probably like your energy when you talk about it isn't like, oh, this big, like, which makes such a difference.
Yeah. And the energetics of that, or like the essence of that, you can feel in how someone speaks. Like I say it with confidence. I say it matter of factly, like this is what happened. And a lot of that work has continued to happen as I've been on some podcasts over the past 6 months and like started to just speak about it matter of factly, because for a while it was like my whole social circle knew, you know, anyone that was friends with my ex-husband only knows his side of the story, which is very obviously one-sided and does not paint me in any kind of a favorable light. And so for me to kind of take back like my side of the story a little bit, and it's symbolic because it's not so much just for his friends and family. I don't even know if they've listened to anything, but it's like, no, this is my story too. Like I may have had an affair and we may have gotten divorced, but that doesn't mean I don't get a right to say how I feel and what happened for me. And so there's like been kind of a reclaiming process of like, well, this is my truth and this is how I felt. I almost felt like after we got divorced, he was treating me as if I were a felon and like I lost my right to vote. Like, and I was traumatic, but like that's the way it felt to me. Just because I did this thing that hurt you doesn't mean that I should be disenfranchised and taken away like a right to feel and a right to have to be angry and a right to have the same feelings that you do. And so I think for me, it's been like, you know, rebuilding my self-worth has given me the confidence to feel like I deserve to see this situation and feel this situation happen the way that it did for me. And that's my reality.
Yeah. And it sounds like, and I think we do this often in our society when we're talking about like why a relationship ends, of it's like, okay, well, you did the, I'm doing air quotes, bad thing of having an affair. Mm-hmm. So you're the bad one, but it's like, right. But relationships are complicated. That's what my dad always said. And they take a lot of work. And like what happened up to that, that was him, you, both of you together, that caused you to feel like you had to look for security somewhere else. And people so want to go to the like lowest common denominator because it's the easiest to understand versus really exploring like the complex feelings and what happened.
Like, yeah, I remember feeling really angry because I felt like, wow, this is really where we are, particularly with cheating and infidelity. There's this like victim and villain mentality that we go into really fast, and it's really gendered. Like all of the men seem to side with him, and almost all, if not all, of the women sided with me, which is just like feels archaic. And I remember feeling really angry that like, so if I had called off our wedding when he cheated on me, I would have gotten all this compassion and sympathy and you would have been the bad guy. Like it's just It felt like that felt really unfair to me, that like we both did this to each other, but because we decided to end it after mine, like none of the backstory is getting included and I'm just being blamed. And that just felt like very convenient for him and is something that I've obviously had to come to terms with, but there's always so much more to the story. And now whenever I, and like, I've always like been someone that rooted for the underdogs, and I love like kind of the comeback story. So whenever I hear a story about infidelity, or particularly when I hear someone describe like, oh, my ex was such an asshole, or something really that sounds like they're really just painting a one-sided story, I always think, and usually ask now, how do you think your ex would describe how you broke up? Like, there is another side of the story. And I think we're doing ourselves a disservice as a culture to just label. And we hear this with women all the time, complaining about men. Men are trash. This man ghosted me. This man cheated on me. This man, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, there are like compulsive philanderers. There are people that gaslight. There are narcissists. But that's not the most common. The most common situation is we both did things to lead to this ending. And like, you're doing yourself a disservice by just playing the victim. Like, you know, confront the parts of yourselves that led to this and make peace with that. Cause that's the only way that you're like, you're going to really grow from this experience.
I think part of what you're talking about too is, again, the developmental stage. Like most of your peer group may have, as you were getting divorced, still had that follow the rules, you win a good life belief system. And, you know, they may feel differently the same way Brooke was saying she felt differently after her dad died and was like, God, I really didn't show up for these other grievers in their life. I wish I had done this differently. Inevitably, statistics tell us are going to have more friends who get divorced. It will be interesting to see how they show up for conversations about divorce differently. I mean, I just sort of think like there are the ideas that we have, and a lot of us try to live our life based on our ideas. And then there are the knowings and the experiences that we have. Like part of what I love about what you just said about dating was that, like, you know, it really was sort of an experiential process that you created a better narrative the more you talked about it, that you've been on podcasts, that you spent some time traveling. But with any loss, you know, there's the period of time where you're in it and your whole system is like, oh my God, what does this mean? But ultimately, in order to live forward, you have to have a narrative that you can say, this is what happened, I got divorced, and do that without it pulling you under the water and making you feel like shit. Because if you're going to do that on a date, you know, you're not going to be able to stay and decide whether or not you like this person or you're attracted to them. You're going to be totally under the water with the shame that you feel about the fact that you got divorced. So part of what you're describing is the building blocks of how do I get ready to date? And Brooke, I remember you saying something similar, which was like, I was dating, but I was kind of a mess. You know, I think we have this idea that like, you got to get back on the horse and you got to do it this kind of way. And your friends want you to be better and they want you to do this thing. And then there's the internal knowing in your system of like, damn, this is rocky for me. This might not turn out. And the one piece that I really want to say is like, I think we are experiential learners about ourselves. And I like a lot of failure. I like a lot of mistakes. One thing that I share with my clients all the time is I spent all this time and money deciding I wanted to run this nutrition class, this yoga nutrition class for kids. And there was a lot of reasons for it. You know, my kids were young at the time, but I bought a lot of yoga mats. I rented space. I took all the money. It was a very well-funded class. People were super into it. I did it 5 times and I was supposed to do it 10. And I was like, I fucking hate this. So I returned all the money. I mean, I knew I hated it. And I was like, I'm not going to show up for this class because I made a promise to somebody else. Like, they can do something else at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning with their 8-year-old children. But I couldn't have known that in my mind. In my mind, it seemed like a great idea. In my experience, I really did not want to do it anymore. And I just sort of feel like anybody who thinks they know anything about how relationships are supposed to go are dissociated from that truth, which is we live a relationship in our 5 senses experience. And we need to be vigilant about attending to those relationships. But just like you said, you were in the sex therapist's office and you were like, shit, now I know something I didn't know, which is I am not attracted to this person. You can't unknow that once you know it. That's what knowings are. And so, you know, it's fine for people to pass judgment on that, but they're only passing judgment on it because they haven't had that experience themselves.
Oh, right. So I would love, like, based on what Megan said of like, you have this experience. And so now, you know, like, what advice would you have to other people who've gotten divorced of like how to move through this re-knowing yourself process that you can date again and show up as this like new version of yourself?
I would say that I think doing, obviously, you know, therapy helped me a lot. And I think that shadow work is actually what turned the corner for me of realizing that like everything that was holding me back in dating was actually not new. And it was not from my divorce. It was reconfirming some limiting belief and like some subconscious belief that I had from a very young age, that it sort of like magnified that. And then if you can work through those things and realize, you know, why do you feel unlovable if you have a flaw? Or why do you think that being emotional makes you too much? Or, you know, whatever it is, I'm just saying those because those are mine and those are common female narratives of like, how do you believe that that would inhibit you from finding love or being successful in love? Then you can start to realize that like, oh, it's actually not about my divorce. Like it's, no one cares about my divorce. Like that it's about me, that I think that love is conditional. And I think that, you know, that I have to be a certain way. And particularly as women, we often think that we have to contort ourselves or self-abandon to receive love, because as children, we had to like, you know, either work around our parents' needs or like show interest in a certain thing to get love from a specific parent. And so that creates this whole narrative and belief system that we take through life of like, I can't just be my full, raw, authentic, uncensored self. I have to be this, I have to be that. And that can look a million different ways for different people. But I think once you realize that it's not about the divorce, it's not about the loss, it's not about anything that happened in that relationship, go back, keep going back and go back to your childhood and think about like how, one, why you attracted that, you know, what was that partner, that ex-partner, like reconfirming? What beliefs was that partner reconfirming that your parents or caregivers instilled in you? And what do you want differently next time? What do you want? Like, what would your real, authentic, like magnetic relationship look like and fulfilling relationship? And then almost like work backwards. So I wrote down like all these things that I wanted. And then it's like, well, am I that person? Am I someone that's, I remember writing down emotionally available. And then I'm like, but am I emotionally available? No. Oh, I got to work on that. Like you be almost like become the partner that you want to attract. Mm-hmm. Or that you want, you know, and then it all, I think it just starts flowing from there. And there's obviously trial and error and you learn. I would say that like, I don't know that the next relationship you're in should be the next marriage. Obviously that happens for some people, but I think getting used to dating is a skill and something that's worth taking time. And like the idea of the mindset of scarcity in the dating field is something that really bothers me, and particularly amongst women, that like, you know, there's not enough good men out there, or that I'm getting older and I have to, you know, that there's not as many of them. And that is really hurting no one besides you. Like that is just really, nothing good is coming from that mentality. And so just believing that as you continue to grow, other people, you'll find people that are growing too.
Can I ask one question, just because it popped up and you described that you had a year long relationship that broke up recently. I'm just curious, with all the work that you have done to sort of center in this new energy, did the ending of that relationship feel similarly like a failure, or did it feel like, you know, we're ending this relationship?
It was totally different. Like the ending of that relationship, I would say, has healed me from my divorce on another level. Like we're still friends, we still talk, we're still on good terms. It was very clear boundaried. It was like the most amicable, like it came very clear to me like that it wasn't going to be long term. I told him that. He said he had been feeling the same way. It was just like the most like conscious uncoupling, to use that term, that I've like ever could have imagined, that I ever wanted for my marriage and just like didn't have the tools to do. So that actually was such a good reflection of like, oh my God, I've grown so much. I just put into practice all this stuff that I've learned, because, you know, all these learnings are only as useful as we're able to actualize and implement them. And so that was like, oh, I really am. I have come a long way. Okay.
That's amazing. That, I mean, I had a hunch that's what you were going to say. And I think for anyone listening, understanding again, basically what you're just describing is that there is life after loss. You know, it's not neutral. You don't get to just sit around and wait for the weather to change. There's work to be done in order to go and embrace the life that you want, regardless of how hard the times are. But I'm so happy for you that that's the answer, because that's the way it should be. We should be able to construct, you know, our own choices without being vilified and, you know, being a villain on account of them. Like, we should be able to say, I choose to not be in this, and not have to be doubled down by everyone deciding that, you know, she's a bad person. It's too simplistic, and we know that's not the case. That's awesome. That's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can really quickly tell us a little bit about your business and where people can find you online if they're interested in hearing from you more.
Yeah. So the concept of my business is that conflicts are opportunity for growth. And so I work with individuals and businesses to consciously navigate transitions, difficult conversations, and negotiations. And obviously I could talk for a lot about that, but that includes shadow work, that includes helping people through divorce, you know, both on the individual, and also I like working with teams and business settings too. So my website, the company is called Parama, and the website is myparama, P-A-R-A-M-A.com. And then obviously you can find me on Instagram. It's Juliana Wex, J-U-L-I-A-N-A-W-E-X. And I'd be happy to chat.
Thank you. And Megan, do you want to say really quickly where people can find you?
Yes. So I'm at Grief is My Side Hustle, all the things. Megan Reardon Jarvis, Instagram. My podcast drops on Tuesdays, so you can come and find that there. Yeah. My website is griefismysidehustle.com.
All right. Amazing. Thank you both so much. This was an amazing conversation, and I'm so glad that we got to do this. So thank you. You can find The Grief Coach online at thegriefcoach.co is our website, and on social at the_griefcoach. And I will talk to you guys next week. Thanks for listening.